It's November 20th, 1953. Over the Mojave Desert, a navy blue research aircraft drops away from the belly of a converted Boeing B-29 Superfortress at 40,000 feet. The pilot lights his rocket engine, the airplane accelerates through the thin air, climbing, pushing past the speed of sound, past the numbers no airplane had ever reached before. And when it's all over, Scott Crossfield has done something no human being had done before. He's flown twice the speed of sound. I'm Tower, this is ATIS on Radio Hangar, and today we're going back to the years when the edge of the envelope was a place you physically went to find out where it was. Today's aviation news is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene a little more because context matters here. World War II ended in 1945, and the United States found itself sitting on top of an enormous amount of aeronautical momentum. The war had accelerated aircraft development at a pace that would have been unthinkable in peacetime. Jet engines that were laboratory curiosities in 1940 became operational fighters by 44. Swept wing theory, rocket propulsion, exotic fuels, pressurized cockpits, ejection seats, the technology was piling up faster than anyone could test it. And so the research aircraft programs exploded. You had Bell, you had Douglas, you had Northrop, all building machines that weren't fighters, weren't bombers, weren't transport aircraft. They were flying laboratories. Their job was simple, if dangerous, go find out what happens at speeds and altitudes nobody has been to yet. Bring back data, let the engineers make sense of it. The National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the NACA, which would eventually become NASA, was running a lot of this work out of Muroc Army Airfield in California, which we now call Edwards Air Force Base. And the Navy had its own program alongside the Air Force, which is how we get to Douglas and the D-558. The designation sounds dry. The airplane was anything but. Douglas actually built two distinct aircraft under the D-558 program, and it's worth separating them because people often mix them up. The first was the D-558-1, which they called the Skystreak. The second, the one that went to Mach 2, was the D-558-2, the Skyrocket. The Skystreak came first, 1947. It was a straight-wing, turbojet-powered research aircraft, clean and simple in its lines, painted international orange so you could see it against the desert sky. The Skystreak's job was to push into the transonic range, that murky territory between subsonic flight and the sound barrier where the aerodynamics get strange and the airframe starts experiencing shocks in places that engineers didn't always predict correctly. In the summer of 47, the Skystreak set back-to-back world airspeed records. Commander Turner Caldwell pushed it to 564 miles per hour on August 20th. Then Major Marion Carl, a Marine aviator, broke that record just 3 days later at 549 knots. These were absolute world records. No aircraft anywhere had gone faster. But the Skystreak was already being outpaced by the research program itself. Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in the Bell X-1 in October of 47. Mach 1 was done. The question immediately became, what's next? How fast can we go? How high can we go? And what does the airplane tell us when we get there? That's where the Skyrocket came in. The D-558-2 Skyrocket was a fundamentally different airplane from its older sibling. Where the Skystreak had straight wings, the Skyrocket had swept wings 45 degrees of sweep because the engineers at Douglas understood that to live in the supersonic world, your airfoil geometry had to change. The straight wing that worked beautifully at 400 miles per hour became a liability when you pushed toward and beyond Mach 1. The Skyrocket was also, and this is the part that makes it truly unusual, a dual propulsion aircraft. It carried a Westinghouse J-34 turbojet engine and a Reaction Motors XLR-8 rocket engine, both at the same time. The jet got you off the ground and up to a reasonable speed and altitude. The rocket could be lit when you needed raw thrust in the thin air where jet engines lose efficiency. Three of these aircraft were built. They flew in different configurations at different times. Early flights were made from a ground takeoff under jet power alone. Later, the aircraft were modified to be air-launched from a B-29, which was a common approach for research aircraft because it gave you a free climb to altitude and let you conserve your rocket fuel for the actual test point rather than burning it fighting your way up from sea level. The program was Navy-funded, but the NACA pilots flew a lot of the research missions. That's an important distinction. Military pilots and civilian test pilots approached these flights somewhat differently. The NAK people were methodical, data-focused. They expanded the envelope one small step at a time, careful to document everything. The military test pilots were, let's say, occasionally more aggressive in their approach. One of the NACA pilots who flew the Skyrocket extensively was a man named Scott Crossfield. Crossfield was a naval aviator who had transitioned into NACA research flying. He had a degree in aeronautical engineering, which made him unusual among test pilots of that era. He didn't just know how to fly the airplane, he understood why it flew the way it did. He could read the data himself. And Crossfield had a particular obsession. He wanted to be the first person to fly at Mach 2, twice the speed of sound. It was a target that had been on the horizon for years, and by 1953, it was beginning to look achievable. The challenge wasn't just speed, it was everything that came with speed. When you push an airplane past Mach 1, the shockwaves that form on the airframe start behaving in ways that affect everything. Control surfaces lose effectiveness or reverse their effectiveness entirely. Trim changes catch you off guard. Heating becomes a factor. The thin aluminum skin of a research aircraft doesn't mind a few minutes of kinetic heating at Mach 1.2, but push toward Mach 2 and you're talking about temperatures that start to matter to the structural engineers. The XLR-8 rocket engine that powered the Skyrocket burned a mixture of alcohol and liquid oxygen. It produced about 6,000 pounds of thrust. In the thin air at 50, 60, 70,000 feet, 6,000 pounds of thrust went a very long way. The Skyrocket was a light airplane carrying a powerful engine, and in the right conditions, it would simply accelerate until you told it to stop. On November 20, 1953, Scott Crossfield strapped into the Skyrocket in the belly of the B-29 carrier aircraft. They climbed to altitude over the Mojave. The Skyrocket dropped away clean. Crossfield lit the rocket, and he flew to Mach 2.005, 1,291 miles per hour. At approximately 72,000 feet, for a brief window of time, Scott Crossfield was the fastest human being alive. Here's what you need to know about what that actually felt like from inside the cockpit, based on Crossfield's own accounts. It wasn't dramatic the way you might picture it. There was no jolt, no explosion of sensation. You're in thin air where the density is a fraction of sea level. The shockwaves are there, but they're quieter. The instrument needles move. The Mach meter climbs, 2.0, 2.002, 2.005. Then you're out of fuel and you're a glider, and you've got to get the airplane back on the ground. The Skyrocket was a glider in its unpowered phase, and not an easy one. The swept wing that made it so efficient at high speed was not your friend in the landing pattern. The approach speeds were aggressive. The margins were narrow. You flew it to the runway, and you flew it all the way to touchdown. There was very little room for error. Crossfield made it back, as he always did. Now, I want to give you the political dimension of this story, because aviation research in the early 1950s was never purely about science. It was also about competition between services, between contractors, between individuals who all understood that records had meaning. The Air Force was not pleased that a Navy-funded aircraft had gotten to Mach 2 first. Chuck Yeager, who had broken the sound barrier in 47 and remained the most famous test pilot in the world, was working at Edwards with the Bell X-1A at the same time Crossfield was flying the Skyrocket. The X-1A was a faster, improved version of the original Mach 1 airplane. Yeager went after Crossfield's record. On December 12, 1953, just 22 days after Crossfield's Mach 2 flight, Yeager flew the X-1A to Mach 2.44, 1,650 miles per hour. He blew past Crossfield's record by a significant margin. But here's the part of that flight that doesn't always make the headlines. Yeager nearly didn't make it back. At high speed and high altitude, the X-1A entered an uncontrolled inertia coupling departure. The airplane started tumbling in ways that the aerodynamics couldn't counter. Yeager lost control completely. The airplane spun, rolled, pitched in ways it was never designed to handle. He fell from 80,000 feet to around 25,000 feet before he was able to recover. The airplane was damaged. Yeager was hurt. He got it back on the ground. The data from that flight fed directly into understanding a phenomenon that would kill pilots in subsequent years. Inertia coupling was an aerodynamic trap built into the narrow fuselage, short-wing design of many early supersonic aircraft. The Lockheed F-104 Starfighter would later earn a grim reputation partly because of this effect, particularly in the German Air Force, where it was operated in profiles it was never optimized for. Research kills, that sounds harsh, but it's the truth of what those pilots understood when they strapped in. The D-558 program as a whole flew more than 300 times over about 7 years. The data that came back from those flights shaped virtually every high-performance aircraft that followed. The aerodynamic understanding of swept wings at transonic and supersonic speeds, the behavior of control surfaces in compressible flow, the structural challenges of sustained supersonic flight, engineers at Douglas, at Boeing, at the companies that would eventually build the Century Series fighters, absorbed the Skyrocket's lessons directly. Scott Crossfield went on to become the first person to fly the North American X-15, which is a story for another day. But it's worth noting the trajectory, the Skyrocket to Mach 2, then the X-15 to Mach 6.7, and the edge of space. The chain of research connects directly. One of the three Skyrocket airframes survived and is on display at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington. If you've ever been to the main building on the Mall, you've probably seen it without necessarily knowing what it was. It hangs alongside the Wright Flyer, the Spirit of St. Louis, the Friendship 7. The company it keeps tells you something about where it belongs in the story of American flight. The other two airframes were expended in the test program. That was the nature of the work. You built the airplane, you learned from it, and sometimes the airplane didn't come back. The pilots understood this and flew anyway. I want to leave you with one thought about this era that I think is easy to lose in retrospect. We know how the story ends. We know that the sound barrier was broken, that Mach 2 was achieved, that humans eventually walked on the moon. When you read history knowing the outcome, the whole thing looks inevitable. Of course it worked out. Of course they figured it out. From inside the program, it didn't feel that way. The pilots climbing into those airplanes in the early 1950s did not know what waited for them at Mach 1.5, at Mach 2, at 70,000 feet. The aerodynamicists had theories, the wind tunnels had data. But the wind tunnels of that era could not accurately model supersonic flow, which is one of the reasons you needed the research aircraft in the first place. You were flying to a place nobody had a reliable map for. That's worth sitting with. Sources for today's segment include The Aviationist, the National Air and Space Museum's archive on the D-558 program, and Scott Crossfield's own account in his memoir, Always Another Dawn. More at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tower, clear skies!